and welcome to Greatest Britons. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. This is the second and final part in our mini-series on Sir Francis Drake, and I'm joined today, as always, by my co-host, Max Musson, from Western Spring. Should we get into our Greatest Britons then, do you think?
Yeah, let's talk about Francis Drake.
Let's get into part three of our presentation on Sir Francis Drake. Last episode, we heard about Drake's circumnavigation of the globe and how he managed to continue capturing Spanish ships along the route. He also suffered from many of his own vessels failing, setting out with six ships in all, but returning with only one, the Golden Hind. He went around the west of North America and headed southwest across the Pacific, encountering Indonesia and eventually Africa. The treasures he brought back for the Queen surpassed all her other income for that year, and he was knighted for his incredible feat. After his knighthood, Drake adopted a coat of arms from what he believed was a distant relative, but the owner complained, so the Queen created new armorials for him, depicting the mythical creature of the former arms being hoisted upside down in the rigging, displaying that she had a keen sense of humour. I was quite surprised at that. One thing that really has struck me about this is this privateering that Drake was doing, where he was just capturing these Spanish ships whenever he could and taking the wealth. And I don't know if we've mentioned this before, but that is exactly the same as what Britain is doing today to Russia, isn't it? Just taking Russian yachts, anything that belongs to anyone rich in Russia that they find in the world, they're just appropriating it for themselves. And it just shows you that nothing's changed in 300 years. You know, the same thing is going on. It's just basic piracy. They talk about having respect for international law. Where is the respect for basic property rights there? You just taking whatever the Russians have, but then that's effectively what Sir Francis Drake was doing. So we haven't really changed in the last 300 years, have we? You got any comments on the recap there, Max?
No, I think the recap's fair enough. I think on the last point you mentioned, things don't change. You know, war is war, and countries have got their own national interests, and will tend to adapt international treaties and international law to suit themselves, or interpret international law and international treaties to suit themselves. And this is the cause of lots of discord between countries. And you've only got to look at the Brexit agreement that was signed between Britain and the European Union to see that over the situation in Northern Ireland, a carefully worded Northern Ireland protocol has been interpreted in two different ways by two different governments that have got different national interests. And so this is always the issue that you have with international agreements, the fact that they tend to be drafted in a language which isn't the first language necessarily of the people that are signing up to either side. And so therefore those people, you know, within the grey area that exists between one person's translation of of the wording of a treaty and another person's translating of the wording of a treaty, you know, there's sufficient grey area there and sufficient scope for people to pretend that they didn't understand the thing that they were signing up to, or the thing they were signing up to didn't actually mean what the other person thinks it means. And yeah, these things happen, don't they? And I don't think anything much is going to change that.
Yeah, so the source of lots of problems, misunderstandings. Well, on the 15th of March, 1587, Drake accepted a new commission with several purposes: disrupt the shipping routes to slow supplies from Italy and Andalusia to Lisbon, to trouble the enemy fleets that were in their own ports, and to capture Spanish ships laden with treasure. Drake was also to confront and attack the Spanish Armada had it already sailed for England. When arriving at Cadiz on the 19th of April, Drake found the harbour packed with ships and supplies, as the Armada was readying and waiting for a fair wind to launch the fleet to attack. In the early hours of the next day, Drake pressed forward his attack into the inner harbour and inflicted heavy damage. Claims of the Spanish ships' losses vary. Drake claimed he had sunk 39 ships, but other contemporary sources are lower, specifically some Spanish sources which suggest losses as low as 25 ships. The attack became known as the Singeing of the King's Beard and delayed the Spanish invasion by a year. So that was very lucky that he got there just as they were supplying and all the ships were in port there. They were just basically sitting ducks. Over the next month, Drake patrolled the Iberian coast between Lisbon and Cape St. Vincent, intercepting and destroying ships on the Spanish supply lines. Drake estimates that he captured around 1,600 to 1,700 tons of barrel staves, enough to make 25,000 to 30,000 barrels for containing provisions. Drake was Vice Admiral in command of the English fleet under Lord Howard of Effingham when it overcame the Spanish Armada that was attempting to invade England in 1588. As the English fleet pursued the Armada up the English Channel in closing darkness, Drake broke off and captured the Spanish galleon Nuestra Señora del Rosario, along with the Admiral Pedro de Valdez and all his crew. The Spanish ship was known to be carrying substantial funds to pay the Spanish army in the Low Countries. Drake's ship had been leading the English pursuit of the Armada by means of a lantern, and by extinguishing this for the capture, Drake put the fleet into disarray overnight, but he did manage to capture all the wages for the Spanish army there. On the night of 29th of July, along with Howard, Drake organised fire ships, causing the majority of the Spanish captains to break formation and sail out of Calais into the open sea. The next day, Drake was present at the Battle of Gravelines, or Gravelines. He wrote as follows to Admiral Henry Seymour after coming upon a part of the Spanish Armada whilst he was aboard the Revenge on the 31st of July, 1588. And he says, "Coming up to them, there has passed some common shot between some of our fleet and some of them, and as far as we perceive, they are determined to sell their lives with blows." The most famous, but probably apocryphal, anecdote about Drake relates that prior to the battle, he was playing a game of bowls on Plymouth Hoe. On being warned of the approach of the Spanish fleet, Drake is said to have remarked that there was plenty of time to finish the game and still beat the Spaniards, perhaps because he was waiting for high tide. There is no known eyewitness account of this incident, and the earliest retelling of it was printed 37 years later. Adverse winds and currents caused some delay in the launching of the English fleet as the Spanish drew nearer, perhaps prompting a popular myth of Drake's cavalier attitude to the Spanish threat. It might also have been later ascribed to the Stoic attribute of British culture. So he's showing a lot of skill here, setting up these fire ships, causing them to break formation, going after the wages, going after the barrels that were needed for the provisions, and getting the fleet while it was still in dock. So he certainly seems to be having a lot of luck here. Have you got any comments on any of that, Max?
Yeah, I think it all reinforces Drake's reputation as being a sort of cavalier, swashbuckling kind of character. I was interested in the number of barrel staves that were being held on some of the ships, and I sort of wondered to myself why the barrels would have been transported as barrel staves. And obviously, if you think about it, if all the barrels were put together and were assembled, then they would actually take up a lot more room than just the bits of wood that make the sides of the barrel. And so probably they would have had a whole load of barrel staves and a whole load of iron hoops that would then be used to make the top and the bottom and the middle sort of supporting band that would hold the staves in place, so that at some point they could assemble the barrels and therefore hold a much greater volume of provisions and things within those barrels. That's quite interesting. And I think that I think we're going to go on to talk about the Spanish Armada and the destruction of the Spanish Armada. And I think I've mentioned in previous programs where we've been speaking about the Spanish Armada that, you know, from my recollection, the reason given for the great success of the English fleet against the Spanish fleet was the fact that the Spanish fleet had been used to fighting in the Mediterranean, where the waves are relatively small and where the tides are relatively small. You know, there isn't a great deal of difference between high tide and low tide, but obviously in the North Atlantic and in the North Sea and the Irish Sea, then the seas are much rougher. And the Spanish had adopted a principle of making their galleons very large and with quite shallow drafts and flat bottoms, effectively, compared to the English ships, because they were used to sailing in waters that weren't particularly rough, whereas the English ships were made with a very deep keel, which made them more stable in rough water. And it was the fact that the British ships had got the deep keel that and they were smaller than the Spanish ships, and therefore more manoeuvrable, that they were able to use more accurate fire from their cannons in order to destroy the Spanish ships' disproportionately, and that then resulted in their success against the Armada.
Yeah, it was really, we had these far more manoeuvrable ships. I've got some more details on it here. English ships sailed from Plymouth to attack the Armada. They were faster and more manoeuvrable than the larger Spanish galleons, enabling them to fire on the Armada without loss as the Armada sailed east of the south coast of England. The Armada could have anchored in the Solent between the Isle of Wight and the English mainland and occupied the Isle of Wight. But Medina Sidonia was under orders from King Philip II to meet up with Alexander Farnese, Duke of Parma's forces in the Netherlands, so that England could be invaded by Parma's soldiers and other soldiers carried in ships off the Armada. English guns damaged the Armada, and a Spanish ship was captured by Sir Francis Drake in the English Channel. The Armada was then anchored off Calais. While awaiting communications from the Duke of Parma, the Armada was scattered by English fire ships in a night attack and abandoned its rendezvous with Parma's army that was blockaded in the harbour by Dutch flyboats. In the ensuing Battle of Gravelines, the Spanish fleet was further damaged and was in risk of running aground on the Dutch coast when the wind changed. The Armada, driven by southwest winds, withdrew north, with the English fleet harrying it up the eastern coast of England. As the Armada returned to Spain around Scotland and Ireland, it was disrupted even further by storms. Many ships were wrecked on the coasts of Scotland and Ireland, and more than a third of the initial 130 ships failed to return to Spain. As historians Martin and Parker explain, Philip II attempted to invade England, but his plans miscarried. This was due to his own mismanagement, including the appointment of an aristocrat without naval experience as the commander of the Armada, but also due to the unfortunate weather and the opposition of the English and their Dutch allies, which included the use of fire ships sailed into the anchored Armada. So the Spanish really, you know, they really weren't thinking there by putting an aristocrat in charge. And we had Drake as the second in command. I guess we had an aristocrat in charge as well, but we had adequate support for that aristocrat in Drake, who had been all around the globe and was our top privateer. And again, it was the winds and the currents that smashed the ships up. It was the same with Julius Caesar. Julius Caesar's first invasion of Britain, there was a gale in the Channel, and that smashed all the ships up. And in his second invasion, a year later, he was in the Thames, and there was adverse winds and storms, and it smashed the ships up. And then we have the Spaniards trying to invade in Drake's time, 1,500 years later, and once again, the Channel gales smash up all the ships. I mean, how about that for a coincidence? Three times when people have tried to invade Britain, the storms have been on our side. What do you make of that, Max?
Well, no wonder that Shakespeare waxed lyrical about this sceptred isle. I can't remember what all the words are with regard to that particular piece of his writing, but you know, he makes it quite plain that the fact that England and Britain have been surrounded by sea, that effectively forms the function of a moat around a castle, that has been the salvation of the British people for sort of over many, many centuries. And yeah, I think that because we have been a seafaring nation, and because Drake, despite the fact that he, you know, was a fairly aristocratic person, had actually achieved his position of aristocracy through his own endeavors as a privateer, and had, as a privateer, had built up obviously a massive amount of experience of seafaring in difficult conditions, getting around the Cape of Good Hope and all that kind of thing, put him in a superior position to an aristocrat that had been chosen by King Philip II to command the Armada. And as I say, with the superior ships that were designed specifically for rough seas, as opposed to the Spanish ships, which were designed for calm seas, it produced the result that we've celebrated in history ever since.
And Shakespeare was writing around this time as well. He was part of the Elizabethan age, and of course Elizabeth I gave a famous speech there as well. In 1589, the year after defeating the Armada, the English sent their own to attack Spain. Drake and Sir John Norreys were given three tasks: seek out and destroy the remaining ships, support the rebels in Lisbon, Portugal, against King Philip II, who was then the king of both Spain and Portugal, and take the Azores, if possible. In the Siege of Coruña, Drake and Norreys destroyed a few ships in the harbour of Coruña in Spain, but they lost more than 12,000 lives and 20 ships of their own. This defeat in all fronts delayed Drake, and he was forced to forgo hunting the rest of the surviving ships and to head on to Lisbon. However, he wanted to change such a bitter thorn, and in order not to return empty-handed and with the morale of his troops sunk, he made a fleeting stop in the Galician Riaz, razing the defenceless town of Vigo to the ground without mercy for 4 days. His crew, without a government and eager for revenge, rampaged around the town until it was reduced to ashes. Even this abusive demonstration of power did not leave the corsair unharmed, as he lost some 500 men on land, in addition to as many wounded. The growing defence of the inhabitants and the arrivals of militias from Portugal put Drake's ships back into retreat again. After an investigation was opened in England to try to clarify the causes of the disaster, Drake, whose behaviour was harshly criticised by his comrades in arms, was relegated to the modest post of commander of the coastal defences of Plymouth, being denied the command of any naval expedition for the next 6 years. That's very ignominious of him. That's sad to see that he did something like that. It seems like he was really just trying to make sure that he got something, that they destroyed something, I guess. But to just destroy a defenceless town and burn it down to the ground without mercy for 4 days, that's not really very good. That's just letting out all his temper and anger on innocent people. That sort of really blots his copybook. I mean, up until now, he's been very good, but it just shows you that we all have our weaknesses, don't we? You got any comments on this disaster here, Max?
Yeah, none of us is perfect. Anybody's career is going to be peppered with successes, but also peppered with the occasional mistake, and that would appear to have been a mistake that Drake made. And he paid a price for it in the fact that he'd been effectively demoted as a result of that. I don't know that we should necessarily place any great sort of store on what's happened there, apart from the fact of learning that having prevailed against immense odds and having then been celebrated as a national hero, that to some extent might have gone to Drake's head and made him a bit more impulsive than he otherwise would be. And I'm sure that had he had a cooler head and sat and thought about it, he would have realised that what he was doing there wasn't actually going to enhance his position whatsoever, and would not have done it. And this is again the thing that is so valuable in people who are national leaders or who are leaders of the armies and the navies of the great nations of the world, that they need to remain grounded and to recognise that they're not omnipotent, that they can't do anything they want, that and if they do start to regard themselves as such, then they're likely, it's likely to be pride that comes before a fall, and so they're much better off by remaining grounded to a certain extent and realising that whilst they have achieved great things, they shouldn't take great achievements for granted.
Yeah, the success seems to have gone to his head somewhat. Well, Drake's seafaring career continued into his mid-50s. In 1595, he failed to conquer the port of Las Palmas, and following a disastrous campaign against Spanish America where he suffered a number of defeats, he unsuccessfully attacked San Juan de Puerto Rico, eventually losing the Battle of San Juan. I mean, he really should have cut his losses after his triumphs, I think. He should have realized that he was, you know, entering a run of bad luck. The Spanish gunners from El Morro Castle shot a cannonball through the cabin of Drake's flagship, but he survived. He attempted to attack over land in an effort to capture the rich port of Panama, but was defeated once again. A few weeks later, on the 28th of January 1596, he died, aged around 56, of dysentery, a common disease in the tropics at the time, while anchored off the coast of Portobello, where some Spanish treasure ships had sought shelter. Following his death, the English fleet withdrew, defeated. Before dying, he asked to be dressed in his full armour, and he was buried at sea in a sealed, lead-lined coffin near Portobello, a few miles off the coastline. It is supposed that his final resting place is near the wrecks of two British ships, the Elizabeth and the Delight, scuttled in Portobello Bay, and divers continue to search for a coffin. So that's nice that he was buried at sea in his full armour. We have
that would be a fantastic find for a diver to make, yeah, wouldn't it, to discover that lead-lined coffin and bring it to the surface. Crikey, that would be a sort of a wonderful thing to find.
And it's a sad end to a really glorious career, you know, ending up getting defeated and then dying of dysentery, but he lives on. I mean, he's had a massive cultural impact. In Valparaiso, Chile, folklore associates a cave known as Cuevo del Pirata, which translates to Cave of the Pirate, obviously, and they associate that with Francis Drake. A legend says that when Drake sacked the port, he became disappointed over the scant plunder. Drake proceeded to enter the churches in fury to sack them and take the goblets. However, he still found the plunder to be not worth enough to take it on board his galleon, hiding it in the cave. Another version, the legend says, a treasure was left in the cave because the plunder had been more than he could take on board. Together with the treasure, Drake would have left a man chained or a sentry to wait for them to return, which they did not. And the treasure is still said to be there, but those who approach it drown. And obviously it's wrong of him to go into a church, but at this time it was a battle between the Protestants and the Catholics, and the Pope was seen as trying to take over Britain, and this is why there was this war with Spain. So they were very much against the Catholics at this time. Further north in Chile, a tale says that because Drake feared falling prisoner to the Spanish, he buried his treasure near Arica, these being one of many Chilean stories about entierros or burrowings. In the United Kingdom, there are various places named after him, especially in Plymouth, Devon. Places there carrying his name include the naval base HMS Drake, Drake's Island, and a shopping centre and roundabout named Drake Circus. Plymouth Hoe is also home to a statue of Drake, and the Sir Francis Drake Channel is located in the British Virgin Islands. Several landmarks in Northern California were named after him, beginning in the late 19th century and continuing into the 20th century. American historian Richard White has shown that these commemorations have origins in Anglo-Saxonism, a so-called racist ideology that was variously used to justify manifest destiny, imperialism, slavery, nativism, and the genocide of indigenous peoples. And of course, that's the politically correct explanation of it. So I thought I would look up what Anglo-Saxonism is. They say Anglo-Saxonism was a racial belief system developed by British and American intellectuals, politicians, and academics in the 19th century. Racialized Anglo-Saxonism contained both competing and intersecting doctrines such as Victorian-era Old Northernism and the Teutonic germ theory, which it relied upon in appropriating Germanic, particularly Norse, cultural and racial origins for the Anglo-Saxon race. Predominantly a product of certain Anglo-American societies and organizations of the era, Anglo-Saxonism was, quote, an important racial belief system in late 19th and early 20th century British and US thought, and it advanced the argument that the civilization of English-speaking nations was superior to that of any other nations because of racial traits and characteristics inherited from the Anglo-Saxon invaders of Britain. And obviously, whoever you are, you're going to think that your people are the best, and you're going to think that your civilization that you are bringing is going to be the best. And obviously, whatever your ethnicity is going to shape what your culture is. I'm not so sure that this was justifying slavery or justifying imperialism, but I generally think that they thought that what they were doing by bringing civilization to people that didn't have it was helping them. I don't think they saw it as discriminated against them or oppressing these people. They thought that they were bringing something that was inherently good and giving it to them. In 2017, Mary Dockray Miller, an American scholar of Anglo-Saxon England, stated that there was an interest in the study of 19th century Anglo-Saxonism. It is regarded as a predecessor ideology to the later Nordicism of the 20th century, which was generally less anti-Celtic and broadly sought to racially reconcile Celtic identity with Germanic under the label of Nordic. And I found that term particularly interesting, because I guess there has always been this friction between the Celts and the Anglo-Saxons, between the Welsh and the English, that goes back to. And then under the label of Nordic, that sort of brought the Celtic identity together with the Anglo-Saxon identity. But apparently Drake was seen as quite a hero by the proponents of this Anglo-Saxonism. So, of course, today he gets attacked for that, even though he freed slaves. Even though his best friend or his best worker on the ship was Diego, who was a freed slave, and he thought so much of him because he was such a great boat builder. I think he generally looked at people to see what their talents were, rather than looking at them and thinking, oh, well, that's a different race, so I'm going to look down upon you or anything like that. I don't know if you've got any comments on this or this Anglo-Saxonism, Max?
Well, ever since I was young, there've been sort of people have had theories about the Aryan peoples who began civilizations and who particularly sort of travelled over the Himalayas into India and created the caste system, and who formed the elite. Societal elites in lots of the early civilizations of the world, etc. And then I've lived through a period since then where anthropologists have said, "Oh no, this is a complete load of rubbish. It's a complete myth, this whole idea." But now what we're finding is that the scientists that are exhuming graves and things that hadn't been discovered in the past, and who are carrying out DNA analysis, and who have assembled a greater amount of knowledge of linguistics and the sort of cultural elements of past societies, are now effectively saying that those old theories were in fact largely correct. And so now there is the peoples who originated in the area, which is strangely now Ukraine, which were called the Yamnaya culture. These were people who were identified as being tall, athletic in build. The Cro-Magnon peoples who occupied most of Europe as hunter-gatherers at the end of the Second World War were tall, athletically built people. The sort of DNA analysis tends to suggest that they are people who were paler skin, that had got the sort of features that generally speaking have been regarded as being Anglo-Saxon features. They're the people who pushed north and west into Scandinavia and created the Scandinavian nations, and who eventually arrived at the British Isles and pushed into Britain and created the ancient British and the English. The people that generally had been regarded as Celts in the past have been shown to be people who were the earlier waves of Yamnaya culture that spread across Central Europe and into Britain and into Ireland. And so the Celts aren't massively different from the people who were the Yamnaya the Yamnaya people and who were later regarded as being Anglo-Saxon. So I think that the denigration of Drake as a result of an antipathy towards a recognition of the historic role played by Yamnaya people and whatever name they've gone under in the past is misplaced, and that there were there was high culture and civilization spread by people who effectively are the direct ancestors of the vast majority of European nations, and that's something that we should be proud of.
Yeah, it is white people that bring civilization with them, and we are all connected up together. And this Yamnaya, from research I've done, they appeared at the same. There were people living in that area that weren't the Yamnaya people. The Yamnaya people suddenly appear, and they have tin working. They know how to make bronze. They are highly civilized, and they just suddenly appear. And they appear at the same time as the civilizations in Syria, Babylon, Mesopotamia, Egypt, and they're all white people, and just spread out from there to India, as you say, with the Aryans that were in India, and spread into Europe. And as over time, they became Celts, they became Anglo-Saxons, all the same people. And to denigrate Francis Drake because he was one of these people, it's just this constant attacks on our history, basically. And because of this, public scrutiny of these memorials has intensified, especially after the murder of George Floyd, when protests against police brutality and racism drew critical attention to place names and monuments connected to so-called white supremacy. Several California landmarks that commemorated Drake were removed or renamed, citing Drake's associations with the transatlantic slave trade, colonialism, and piracy. Sir Francis Drake High School in San Anselmo, California, changed its name to Archie Williams High School after former teacher and Olympic athlete Archie Williams. A statue of Drake in Larkspur, California, was also removed by the city authorities. Multiple jurisdictions in Marin County considered renaming Sir Francis Drake Boulevard, one of its major thoroughfares, but left the name intact when they failed to reach a consensus. In San Francisco, the Sir Francis Drake Hotel was renamed the Beacon Grand Hotel. And don't forget, I mean, he freed slaves, basically. If they weren't able to be sold, he freed them, and he gave them a certificate of freedom. His best friend was a freed slave. He travelled around the world, and his piracy was carried out under orders from the monarch. I mean, he had his letters of patent or whatever it was to say that he could attack Spanish ships. He wasn't just attacking any ship. He was attacking the enemies of Britain. And yet, because of this, somehow this gets linked to George Floyd, and we've got to pull down all the statues and all the names of Sir Francis Drake. In British Columbia, Canada, where some theorize he may also have landed to the north of the usual site considered to be Nova Albion, various mountains were named in the 1930s for him, or in connection with Elizabeth I or other figures of that era, including Mount Sir Francis Drake, Mount Queen Bess, and the Golden Hind, the highest mountain on Vancouver Island. Do you want to comment on any of that, Max, before we get into his will?
Well, I think that those people that claim that people who are advocates of Anglo-Saxonism, etc., are being racist, are themselves being racist, because the point is that if you look at the various parts of the world, there would have been the Aboriginal peoples, and by Aboriginal I mean the very first people to go to that particular land and occupy it. There would have been Aboriginal peoples that would have, for example, crossed the Bering Straits and gone into North America from Asia, and who would have then travelled down through North America, through Central America and into the southern parts of America. And there wouldn't have just been one invasion. There would have been successive waves of people doing that. And what happened was that one particular wave was composed of people who had a greater appreciation of science, and who were able to construct buildings from stone, and who were capable of very very beautiful and very accurate stone workings, and so were able to build high walls and temples and cities and they then formed the Central and Southern American peoples, the Incas and the Mayans, etc. And they would have taken the land from the very first people that would have got there, and they would have uplifted the people that survived from those that were conquered by them, so that those people could participate in the culture, the higher culture that the Mayans and the Incas were bringing with them. And so all over the world, there has been a kind of a succession of expansions of the most vigorous groups within humanity. And the expansion of those most vigorous groups has resulted in the sort of cultural and racial distribution of peoples around the world that existed perhaps in the 17, 1800s. For people today, the sort of people who are very woke, to be so sort of po-faced as to say that, well, you know, the people who conquered and created empires in the past, well, they're okay because we kind of keep our fingers crossed and hope that they weren't white people, and we hope that they were brown people, and so therefore we hope we're going to regard that as being absolutely okay. But the people that we know that went around the world and who were more vigorous and who created and expanded their civilizations and who expanded science and technology, etc., the ones that we know were white, well, they're horrible and racist, but not the ones that came before them who were brown. And so basically the people who promote that kind of anti-Anglo-Saxonism are guilty of the same racism that they accuse us of, and that's sort of ironic and something that we ought to make more noise about.
One thing that strikes me about this is that in the 1930s it seemed we were really wanting to honour our ancestors, naming lots of places after Sir Francis Drake, naming all these mountains after him, and fast forward 90 years and we're doing the opposite. You know, it seems like there was this big movement of look at the great things that we've done, and we need to honour these great people around about the 1930s. And yeah, nowadays we have the opposite. Drake's will was the focus of a vast confidence scheme which Oscar Hartzell perpetrated in the 1920s and the 1930s. He convinced thousands of people, mostly in the American Midwest, that Drake's fortune was being held by the British government and had compounded to a huge amount. If their last name was Drake, they might be eligible for a share, if they paid Hartzell to be their agent. And the swindle continued until a copy of Drake's will was actually brought to Hartzell's mail fraud trial, and he was then convicted and imprisoned. So people are still trying to carry out swindles in his name in the 1920s and the 1930s. Finally, we have Drake's drum. Drake's drum has become an icon of English folklore with its variation of the classic King Asleep in the Mountain story motif. It is a snare drum that Sir Francis Drake took with him when he circumnavigated the world. Shortly before he died, he ordered the drum to be taken to Buckland Abbey and vowed that if England were ever in danger and someone was to beat the drum, he would return to defend the country. And according to legend, it can be heard to beat at times when England is at war or significant national events take place. Several times throughout history, people have claimed to have heard the drum beating, including when the Mayflower left Plymouth for America in 1620, when Admiral Lord Nelson was made a free man of Plymouth, when Napoleon was brought into Plymouth Harbour as a prisoner, and when World War I first began in 1914, and when HMS Revenge was closed down and at the point of sailing as part of the Grand Fleet before Jutland. Reportedly, on HMS Royal Oak, a victory drum roll from a drum was heard when the Imperial German Navy surrendered in 1918. The ship was then searched twice by the officers and then again by the captain, and neither a drum nor a drummer was found on board, and eventually the phenomenon was put down to the legendary drum. In 1938, when Buckland Abbey was partly destroyed by fire, the drum was rescued and taken to safety at Buckfast Abbey. Plymouth was devastated in the air raids that followed, reminding some of the ancient legend that if Drake's drum should be moved from its rightful home, the city will fall. The drum was thus returned, and the city remained safe for the rest of the war. And the drum was most recently reported to have been heard in 1940 at the Dunkirk evacuation during World War II. So rather interesting there. Maybe somebody snuck something in there that sounded a bit like a snare drum. I mean, is it a supernatural thing? I mean, it's great that we have this myth that's still going into the last century. It's a national myth. I had heard of Drake's drum before, but didn't really know much about it. Have you heard of this myth before, Max?
No, I've not heard of the myth. As you were sort of telling us about it, it sort of occurred to me that if it had been a large bass drum with a slow beat, it could have actually been people hearing their own the beat of their own heart through their sort of head. Because if you sit very silently in a very silent location and you concentrate on your own heartbeat, you can actually hear the beating of your own heart. And so that was the case. But in fact, a snare drum is one of these small drums that that has very sort of rapid drum beats too. And so I can't imagine the myth is true. It's probably just the imagination of the people in various points in time when they are very emotionally charged.
It's like
they are at times of war.
Yeah, it's like a reimagining of the King Arthur myth, isn't it? Arthur is supposed to be somewhere with his knights, just waiting to be awoken to defend Britain again. And now we have this modern version of the myth with Sir Francis Drake. I think it's great we have these British myths here. There's one with the ravens. If the ravens are ever supposed to fly from the Tower of London, London will fall. There was another one. I think King Bran had his head buried facing France. If ever that was moved, then the French would invade. All sorts of little myths like that. And it's wonderful that this one lasted up until last century. He was a very, very important character, a great hero to the British people, and worthily in our greatest Britons, I think, Max. So you got any final thoughts on Sir Francis Drake?
Well, just to reiterate again that he was a kind of swashbuckling kind of guy, an adventurer, somebody who wasn't afraid to sort of go out on a limb. The sort of person that that legends are made of, effectively, and it's quite appropriate that a kind of a legend has grown up around him, he's the sort of person that one would hope there are still many of his type around Britain today, and I would imagine there probably still are people who just don't yet recognise their full potential. Or haven't realised their full potential, and that we should aim to emulate the daring do of people from our past, because that is the embodiment of striving to be better, of striving to achieve more, and without that sort of drive of daring do, you know, he who dares conquers or wins, whatever he who dares wins. The you know, that kind of a spirit is the sort of spirit that motivates people who achieve exceptional things. And we should, as a nation, aim to achieve exceptional things. And so we have to be prepared to put ourselves in the right mindset so that we're able to dare to be great again. In the same way that our ancestors in the past dared to be great.
Another fine example from our past, another archetypal Englishman. Thank you very much for listening. Do check out the Greatest Britons archive to see who some of our other greatest Britons have been. And keep an eye out later in the year for more in the series.